Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good day, Internet. It's Monday, November 25th, and I'm your host, Rab Zachney. Today, I've got a two-for-one proposition for you. For the first half of our show, we've got an interview with Harebrained Schemes' Mitch Gittleman, where we talk about the past and future of Battletech and his own past and future in the games industry. And then in the second half, Austin and I are going to discuss our experiences with the latest Battletech expansion, Heavy Metal, and talk about where we're at with that franchise in light of my interview with Mitch. But first, let's get to that interview. Last month, I attended Paradox Interactive's PDXCon 2019 in Berlin at Paradox's invitation and at their expense for travel and lodging. You may have already heard our interview with Paradox design director Johan Andersen. Mitch was also there promoting the Heavy Metal expansion for Battletech, but we had a chance to discuss where he's at right now in a long career that has taken him from FOSSA to Microsoft to Paradox and a lot of places in between.
Just overall, where Battletech stands right now, as a franchise, as an IP?
I would say that it's gotten a resurgence, which is really cool. If you look, the board game guys are here from Catalyst, and they've just started putting out all new Battletech stuff, new board games, new stuff. There was a giant Kickstarter for them, too, so I'm excited for them. I'm excited for board game people, you know. That's where we started, right? And so with Battletech also, I mean, we're sort of servicing this long-time audience, this 35-year audience, but a lot of people that I'm meeting have never heard of Battletech. So it's kind of fun also for them, I think, to play a sort of modern tactical game that has a shit ton of lore to it, too. It's over like 200 novels and stuff like that. So I think people are really enjoying that part of it, too, you know?
One thing I'm curious about, because I was a Battletech guy when I was growing up.
Cool.
Is that, like, what you were showing yesterday looked cool. Like, new mechs, new weapon systems, special abilities on mechs.
Yeah.
But also it did remind me of something that I think became a tension within Battletech over the years, which is you always have to keep expanding, you have to keep evolving.
Right.
And so you end up with, like, kind of broken power curves, you end up with, like, gimmick stuff. And how do you, like, balance that tension between, I have to keep this game fresh, I have to keep it evolving, but also there's a point where, like, probably things need to be left as they are, or things need to be used carefully?
Well, first, we are careful, but what we're not is timid, right? That's how you ruin a franchise, being timid with it. Instead, the most important thing is to be respectful of it. Like, you're recording this, but like, I always wanted to make a Star Wars game up until episode one. And then it's like, I'm totally uninterested in this anymore. And I'm seeing The Force Awakens and all that shit, but it's sort of like, it's part of pop. I'm no longer
that. It never went back to where it was.
Yeah, it doesn't have my heart anymore the way it used to. With Battletech, you know, that's why, like, all the new special equipment we're putting on all these mechs is all designed to reinforce the lore, right? Yeah. So if you read the novels and you've read about the Marauder and what its role, it's like, okay, we're trying to get that back. So that's what I mean by not being timid.
Yeah.
It's like, this is respect. This is what this, you know, this is how this is supposed to feel. This is how we always wished it would feel. We, at least, you know, the design team. This is the way we always wished it would feel. So I think that's how we're doing. And then there's that coil beam, if you remember. And that's
sort of
one.
Kinetic energy.
Yeah. And here, now we give some more use to light mechs so that they're more valuable later in the game, you know.
Yeah.
So I consider that service.
Now, I'm curious, how obligated are you to hew closely to the canon built over the years? Like, because one of the things I noticed
I'm not contractually obligated, if that's what... No. But here's the thing. You know who Phil Spencer is, right?
Yeah.
All right. Phil's a great guy, for real, in real life. He's just this great guy. And we were talking at lunch one day, because, you know, I was a longtime Microsoft guy. And after I founded Harebrained Schemes, he and I were talking. He's like, you guys are stewards of this franchise. You're stewards of Shadowrun. and I never worry about you. And that's, I guess, one of the reasons why there's no contractual obligation. Yeah. We just think of it as, I don't know, our role. You know, it's just part of the mantle. It's like, okay, we're BattleTech developers. Therefore, we should behave like BattleTech developers as opposed to some people that make superhero movies that maybe,
yeah,
you know, it's that kind of thing. You know, I take this shit too seriously. We take it too seriously.
But one thing that sort of struck me as I was playing the BattleTech campaign, for instance, is like, it's recognizably using the same settings, the same period as 1925, 1928, before the Fourth
All the great houses exist.
Yeah. But what was interesting was, I remember, because I actually went back and I read the Stackpole Warrior trilogy long ago. And it's amazing how much back then BattleTech was very much like House Davian, the good guys, House Lau, or these mustache twirling villains.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is, like, the BattleTech game you guys made isn't quite so Manichaean, I suppose, in terms of how it depicts sides, and also it's a little more like critical of the great houses in general.
We think of it as Game of Thrones in space, in a lot of ways. It predates Game of Thrones, by the way. So,
But I'm curious, like, to what degree do you view some of those like old story beats as like open to reinterpretation or revision as you go?
Well, they did get reinterpreted in a way, because if, later on, Davian was the good guys, but then later on there were novels and things like that that they were, you know, they were on the other side, and you were looking at it from a different perspective. You know, as instead of the vanquisher, it was the vanquished, and seeing it from their perspective. And for us, and same thing for Shadowrun, you know, we see things as, what if this was real? These are real human beings. You know, stories can't be black and white. Even our story, which is pretty black and white, the story of Kamea and her uncle, it's pretty black. And yet, no, we still put nuance in, and she's wrong during the story, and she learns really hard lessons. So I just think of that as a gentle, modern update. Just very gentle, just, wait a minute, our point of view versus the 80s, you know, has to evolve. The world is way more connected than it was back then, and we have to take other people's points of view into it. And that's our worldview at Harebrained Schemes. It's important to us, you know, not to represent, but to, we're humanists.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's not just like, we can't do mustache twirling. It just doesn't work for us.
You have that context of, like, you worked at Microsoft Games during, like, a pivotal period.
One day, I should show you, because when I do speeches and stuff like that, you know, I do public speaking a lot. When I put up the slides of, here's what I've done and here are the roles I've had, it's really stupid. Yeah. You know, it's like, because I've been in startups and indies and megacorps and now this sort of paradox thing is fascinating. I've been a publisher. I'm sorry, I didn't get to your, I just think it's fascinating
That's kind of the context for...
The perspective's fascinating.
Yeah, and where you're at now in terms of... honestly, this is kind of just a more reflective question, but like, in terms of where you're at right now, is like, is this sort of the best destination you've had in games? Or how does
I'm
that,
really
how
glad
does it compare
you
to
that,
the
Microsoft I really appreciate that question. Yeah. Here's the answer, because I know the answer because it happened to me. Once we sold the company to Paradox, right, we were going through, and of course there are growing pains that happen whenever you join companies together. That happens. And I'm like... And I was just thinking, what do I want? What do I want? I'm laying in bed one night, and like, I got to decide what my future is. And about 3 a.m, I go, I know exactly what my future is. This is exactly what I'm looking for. This is what I've always been looking for. I have a studio filled with people that I interviewed every single person in the studio, right? Yeah. You know, every single person is handpicked. Right, that's a big deal, because I've inherited a lot of teams and I've had to blend different teams, and that is nuts. So we have a culture that we created from scratch. Everybody in it is handpicked. Now we have a stable platform from which to make games with Paradox. We've got these business people, we've got marketing people, we've got, you know, all sorts of really smart people there that really understand what collaboration is and want to do it. And so this is singularly the best part of my entire career right now. And I'm turning 55, and I feel like, oh, autumn is awesome. You know what I mean? It's really cool. It's like, oh, shit, the leaves are falling and it smells great. And this is me right now. So, yeah, you hit me at just the right time.
In terms of your approach to that, like, on the one hand, you, like, clearly yesterday, for instance, you're not the lead designer on New Battletech.
Oh, no.
Like, this stuff falls to the team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To people junior to you. I'm curious, how do you balance that role between, like, one of the things that always impressed me, like Sid Meier did, right, was step back and, like, cultivate talent, but don't necessarily be, like, parachuting in other people's projects.
Yes.
How do you walk that line? Like, what's the line between, like, clearly you love this shit.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly you enjoy weighing
in.
But also, you got to let your team grow and run and develop.
Yeah,
so how do you walk that line?
Well, luckily, over 25 years of this, I've learned how to do it wrong, right? Before I was a game developer, I was a management trainer. Right? So I've got this perspective of that. So here's how I do it. It's pretty simple. The way to truly empower people to do their best work is to talk about the goals. This is what we're trying to accomplish this. This is why. This is what we hope to get out of it. You know, here are the pillars of the game, and here are why, you know.
How do you handle those? Like, this comes up in writing all the time, the whole, like, kill your darlings.
Yeah, right?
The thing that is cool, and it's very cool. And it's a good idea, but there's something about it that's just not quite coming together. And I'm curious, like, how you... Because
I've spent $1 million on a game and cut it. Spent $1 million on a game and cut it. This isn't right. That happened. Yeah, fun.
And there's a lot of good stuff there. It just
The work is fantastic. As a matter of fact, we've had features. You know, it's like, this is good work. You know, I see your design thing here. I see whatever. It's just not coming together right. And we're running out of time and we can't get it. Maybe in an update or something like that, we'll get it, but we're cutting it. And the team, because of the way they've, because of the people we've hired and because of the training and because we're all goal oriented, they're just very production minded. Sometimes I've had people come to me saying, we got to cut this feature, their favorite feature. They have to cut their own and they get nothing but support because I'm a former producer. I knew, you know.
So very little self-deception.
No. That's, you know, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I'm very proud of them for that. Yeah. Very little self-deception. Yeah. We're honest people. We're honest and direct. That's who we are. And
to that, I think one of the things that has been impressive throughout, like, playing through Harebrained's games is that, one, they're very inclusive in terms of
perspective.
Glad you noticed. And... the sort of options they provide for characters. And that was reflected just down to, like, character selection and creation in Battletech.
Yeah.
And that's also reflected in the team you have at
Oh, yeah.
Right.
We try.
And I guess the thing I'm curious about is there's a lot of places that say they're trying. There's a lot of places that, like, in an ideal world would like to be more inclusive, more diverse, but just aren't. They don't pull it off.
Yeah.
Looks like Harebrained has broadly succeeded in this. Like, what's the difference between, like, having good intentions and, like, falling short of them and doing nothing versus...
I actually have an answer for that.
Yeah.
First of all, everybody pulls everybody else along. So if you want to be inclusive, some of the people we've hired actually are kind of experts in inclusivity.
Yeah.
Right? So now we bring somebody in who is actually... You know, a member of an underrepresented, an underrepresented group. And then luckily, they know how to think about that. And the secret of this whole thing is never thinking you understand, never thinking you got it. It's never the way it works. You're in a constant learning mode, you're in a constant growth mindset, right? And, you know, I fuck up all the time, right? And you don't apologize. You just correct your mistake and move on, right? Because nobody wants to hear your fucking apology. They just want it fixed. So that's how we do it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's how you do it with the gray beard and stuff. It's just constant listening. And it's like, oh, yeah, I get it. Just adaptation, constant adaptation.
To that point of the gray beard, autumn being awesome.
It comes up.
But... I think one thing that we see across a lot of fields is that you see a great deal of diversity in junior positions.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes time to, like, who is going to be in leadership positions. Who's who's going to be allowed to manage.
Yeah.
Suddenly, like, you see a lot more homogeneity starting to enforce itself across a lot of different orgs.
Yeah.
And
I know why,
too.
Because there's this unconscious bias. People who manage like me, I want to put in management roles. right? Yeah. That happens, right? It's like, well, they talk like me, therefore they should be managers. Here's a great example of it. Ryan Burrell, who's the lead designer of this expansion, is dramatically different communicator than Connor Monahan, who was the lead designer of our last one, Urban Warfare. Dramatically different people, dramatically different leaders, right? One is much more like me, sort of in your face and boisterous, and another one is simply thoughtful and calm and measured, right? And part of the secret is to understand that the person doing the promoting has to be self-aware of, like, oh, I see. Wait a minute. This guy's good. This guy's just as good. You got to, you know, or this person's just as good. You got to give them a chance. So watching that bias is a big deal. And that's real hard.
Yeah.
And it all comes back to the same damn thing, listening, listening, listening. You know, one of the things we're doing now at Harebrained is really focusing on how different people communicate, because if you're not a type A personality, you can get lost in the dust somewhere, feel like you're lost, and that's stupid. It's just dumb. And so a lot of times I say to somebody, to people, hey, we've got a Q&A, you know, ask me anything. But there are people that don't want to. I say, so put it in Slack.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. You don't want to put it in Slack because you don't want to be, you don't even want your name associated with the question. You just want the question. Send it to our chief operating officer and she'll give it to me with the names filed off. You know what I mean? Just so that different communicators are able to communicate their way. You got to meet people where they are. And that's been a big learning.
Yeah. Well, that's tough though, because like, we do have this sort of a culture of, like, we have a culture that rewards type A's. People who
Microsoft, oh my God. That's one of the reasons why I was able to rise so high at Microsoft, because they love type A's.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm pretty fucking type A. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and, like,
and that's where I learned to be really biased against people that weren't.
Right. And but at the same time, like, also just the way meeting dynamics are set up, like, people who speak up, people who are... studies keep showing we don't actually process what people say. We just, like, how do they say it? That's what we see.
Well, my daughter says there are two types of communicator, chewers and spewers.
Yeah.
Right? The one who's in VR now. So the chewers have to hit their hard drive. The spewers work in RAM. Right?
Yeah.
And so people who work in RAM, everybody thinks, wow, they're brilliant. No, they're just fast on their feet. It's a different thing. The people that hit their hard drive come up with, have you thought about these 12 things?
Right.
No, you didn't.
But how do you find those people who, like, they're not going to dazzle you in a meeting? In fact, they might even be shy. They might be a little, like,
no, that's, drawing. You know, our head of, was it people and, basically our recruiter, but it's more than that. The person who recruits for our company takes a long-term view of the people we hire and stuff. And when we think of diversity, it's not just racial or cultural or stuff like that. It's also communication diversity, too. And it's just, you pay attention to it.
Yeah.
That's a job that, sorry, this is a retail thing, because I used to be in retail. A job that's inspected is respected. You know, you focus on the thing, you can do the thing. You just have to pay attention to it and say this is important and be consistent with it, and then you get it. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
You just pay attention. You know, make it a conscious effort. The trick is not to sleepwalk your way through managing a video game studio.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, and we're back. So, Austin, before we get into heavy metal, I did want to call attention to – I think it's I enjoy how forthright Mitch is in a lot of places, and he's very off the cuff and very much somebody who is super into the same nerd shit that guys like us are. Mm-hmm. But there it was also very funny as we were talking about representation and diversity, how as Mitch is sort of focusing on making sure that there's an inclusive culture, it's hysterical to me that also he cites two white male expansion designers that he's worked with on ongoing BattleTech development. And I think it's kind of a revealing thing, right? Because there's a lot of people, I think, who want to do the right thing, want to evolve their workplace in the right direction. But also when you're like, so who's in leadership positions around you?
Well, the irony there for me is like, there are people on that team that you can point to who are, you know, who would fit the bill for diversity in leadership positions on that team. As far as I know, Algernon Bolden is a black man who is like the lead programmer or lead engineer on BattleTech, and Kiva, oh, I forget her last name, Magan. Kiva Magan was like the gameplay lead on that game, and like those are leadership roles in a real way. She was lead designer, and she's a trans woman, and it's like, point to those people who are awesome and who I've seen you work with on stream before. So like, you know, like you said, revealing in some way, a little awkward maybe, but
you know. Well, and I think it's just very emblematic of the story of like, why do well-meaning institutions often fall short of diversity
right
goals? Because in the end, a lot of times, like, unconscious bias is a real thing, right? Like, it is a very real phenomenon where people who genuinely and sincerely want change and want improved representation within an organization, when push comes to shove, will put in the kind of leadership positions that will have enormous power for shaping the direction of an organization or the direction of what it creates, will put familiar types of people and archetypes in those roles. And it can be really frustrating to see there's always this emphasis on recruitment for diversity, but never a corresponding emphasis in career development for diversity.
Right.
And I think that's just a broader problem. This is not a harebrained schemes problem by any stretch of the imagination. I think this is an organization that does try to do this stuff right. But it is revealing because even there you encounter some of this phenomenon.
Yeah.
The other things we talked about in that interview is BattleTech has this history of, like a lot of tabletop games, you have to keep expanding. You have to keep creating, here's the new shit, here's the new setting, here's the new story beat. And in the history of the tabletop game, everyone loves the clan invasion, but the clan invasion is also where the tabletop game starts getting really swingy. Lots of special rules start getting introduced, and they all have to play nicely with that bed of original game that it was built on. And as he was sort of unpacking stuff that's new in heavy metal, like a kinetic energy weapon that fast mechs run around and they charge it. Yeah. They charge up their weapon. They basically sorry.
It's a very goofy idea. Have you used it yet?
No.
Oh, it fucking rules, dude. Let me tell you about a fucking Jenner that can do 125 damage if you angle it right.
Jeez, excuse me. Is it all direct rules. One area damage?
It's a single hit. Yeah, it's like a medium laser or something like
so
that.
So you can just core someone.
You would absolutely core someone. It is the best version of this. I put it on a Jenner because that's all I had available. But the assassin is like an assassin, right? So let me find what's the assassin special ability, which we'll get to. There's all these things. Oh, assassin has a thing called the assassin intercept system, which is able to ignore a chunk of evasion pips generated by certain units. So it can it is an assassin. It's like meant to take out light mech units. And so that plus this coil weapon, which puts out a ton of heat if you do it for the 100 point damage or 125 point. It's like, it basically is however it. The coil weapon does damage proportional to how many evasion pips you have. Right. So if you have a character who has statted themselves in a way where they get extra evasion in a mech that's able to move a lot and move quickly, you could just do tremendous damage with this thing. It generates a ton of heat, and it is very goofy in the sense that it is very soft sci-fi. I don't know where that energy is coming from, but also we're in 50, 100 ton battle mechs that no one should fight with to begin with, that have PPC cannons, that now have snub nose PPC cannons. I know that was a thing from the tabletop game, but it's so goofy to be like, yeah, we just took the cannon and cut the end off of it. It's very funny.
Just a sawed-off PPC.
It's a sawed-off PPC, and it's more of a sawed-off PPC in heavy metal than it was in the tabletop games. In the tabletop game, it's basically like, I want a medium laser, but I don't want... I like PPCs better, so I'm going to take a saw to this thing. Here, it is at least... It does, like, splash... It does, like, the... like a scattershot effect. It can miss and hit something behind them. It, like, literally is, like, six tiny PPC, like, energy balls. It's actually really cool. Anyway... Going back to you, the point you're making is these are goofy things that are hard to balance, right?
Well, and not just that, but also, like, there's a certain... The first game you make, there's an opportunity for kind of elegance and simplicity there, right? Mm-hmm. Where here is the core set. This is not only the thing that we're going to introduce, but in a lot of cases, the core rule set of a tabletop game is kind of probably the most considered or distilled version of that game.
Right. You've cut away maybe the things... Yeah, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it comes up lacking. Like, oh, I wish there was a little bit more to this. The design doesn't have a lot of interesting points of interactivity between players, or doesn't necessarily have a lot of interesting choices for me to make. Maybe there's kind of like a too optimized play, you know, strategy, stuff like that can happen in a version 1.0. But I think you're generally right that you're like, in a good game, the 1.0, the first release, that barring for need for errata and you know, typos and stuff like that, the core design is functional.
And even as more features are added, even if they serve a useful purpose, addressing a thing that was maybe left undone in the first version, a lot of times that also comes at a cost of just layering in new complexity, or to the point about like the snub-nosed PPC, the idea of, well, it's the same thing functionally, but it's a little bit different, but it's mostly aesthetic just because you like this flavor of damage over this other one.
Right.
And with heavy metal, I felt like here's potential for this to start happening with Battletech, because I thought the world of Battletech 1.0.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the flashpoints. We're basically just chained 1.0 missions together into like sort of mini narratives.
Yeah.
I was cool with all that. With heavy metal, we're getting into new mechs, new weapon types like kinetic energy weapons. We've got mortars that They do just massive AOE damage.
Which is not a thing that was really in this game before. I think the last update, Urban Warfare, technically you could think about something like AOE, but not really. The last big update included the thing where stray shots could hit things around them. And the reason that was important in Urban Warfare was if you fired a salvo of missiles and you missed the fast mech that you're aiming at, maybe they slam into the building behind the fast mech and bring it down. Or if there are a lot of enemies clustered, there's a chance that sort of spray of missiles ends up hitting people in the back. But that's incidental. That's collateral. That's not an AOE attack that you set up to be an AOE attack. The mortar is an AOE attack.
And the mortar in those urban environments that are now in the game will just demolish buildings.
It's sick.
So, like, it's very much like, man, street fighting is difficult. It would be better if there were no streets. So it's like Battletech, you know.
Yeah.
Now with war crimes.
Now with absolutely with war crimes.
But it is a neat addition. But just looking at it sort of from this position of simplicity or straightforwardness, I'm also always waiting for that jumping the shark moment, right? Because there were moments with the Battletech tabletop where you'd see stuff implemented in the game when you realize that like Gauss rifles always had the chance to do a one-shot headshot kill.
That's it.
Of just about any mech on the table. And the odds were long, but they weren't that long to get that to happen. And once you realize that could just happen, it was kind of frustrating. And so,
You think that's frustrating more than fun?
In the tabletop setting, I think it is. Because there's setup time.
Yeah. You're right.
In the game, I don't know, man. Like, it's fun when it happens to someone else.
See, I think it's still fun when it happens to me. It sucks. I love it. It is like the core of this design for me is that, you know, one in 100 It's not one of the 100 by the time you get up there in the levels, I guess. I guess that's fair to your point, is that, like, I do get a lot of head hits in the late game because enemies are stacked and are able to fling missiles at me. They don't really get the Gauss rifle that can one-shot me, but they do have AC-20s, and AC-20s can absolutely just wreck anything other than an assault, right?
Yeah. Yes, but I guess that is... The AC-20, so actually the AC-20 is a perfect example. The AC-20 was this like god tier weapon that had so many limitations in the original version of the tabletop game.
Yeah.
That like if you were carrying on the AC-20, you had very few shots with it, and they needed to land because the opportunity cost for having an AC-20 was just so huge. And God help you if while you were trying to close distance with the AC-20, you get a crit on it and you're like, great. Now just, I guess I'll punch these guys with this busted AC-20.
Totally.
And the Gauss rifle was comparatively light. And so it was like, what if an AC-20 could just hit you from farther away than a PPC?
Yeah, it's the opposite of the snub-nosed PPC, right? It's the AC-20, but at range. It's the great.
And so I'm always waiting for Battletech to like jump the shark, right? Yeah. Where it's like, everything's got to be bigger, hit harder.
Do you think heavy metal is doing that in a bad way for you? How much, I guess, what is your experience with heavy metal? Can we actually set up what heavy metal?
So I have not played too much. Okay. Like I restarted a campaign.
Yes. Which is kind of a weird way to do this. I also did that. How was your experience?
Probably a
that?
Poor way to do this.
You know what? I think it's a good way to analyze where Battletech is with the season pass. I think it's probably a bad way to evaluate just heavy metal. To evaluate just heavy metal, I had to do three different things, which was start a new campaign, jump into a career mode in the middle of a career, because all these expansions that they've done just slot into the game. They're not let me just set up what this is a little bit, and then I'll explain. And the third thing I did was I picked up my post-game from my main campaign, where everything's unlocked, basically. These expansions, this is the third one. There was Urban Warfare was the middle one. What was the first one called again?
Wasn't it just Flashpoint?
Flashpoint was just Flashpoint, right. Each of them have added Flashpoints, which are these like mini special missions, often chained together as like a mini campaign chapter. Rob, you should play the one in this because I haven't finished it yet, but I do think it's the thing you're afraid of happening is happening. That is going to be what Battletech 2 is. We're getting the clan invasion. I haven't gotten there yet, but I'm up against Star League. Shit, I'm at the edge of the map.
You think they're just going to skip Fourth Succession War entirely?
They might. But, like, at the very least, they're setting up that is going to happen in whatever the next big thing is. Anyway, so they add these little mini campaigns. They add new mechs. Some new mechs get added in patches, but most of them come in these big expansions. They add new biomes. Flashpoints added jungles. Urban Warfare added urban environments, which are really distinct to fight in. And I think only really came alive for me in this set of content. They add new mission types. I think in general, one of the biggest changes between playing Battletech when it launched last year and now is way more one-on-one missions, way more three-sided fights that are really dynamic and really fun. And there's been a lot of me like maneuvering to try to get two different enemies to fight each other more than me. Or like these temporary alliances are like, oh shit, like we're a bunch of mediums and a heavy came on board, and that turns out that my side and the other side, the kind of third spoiler side, have targeted that heavy together or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. That stuff has been really fun. And then in this specific case, heavy metal, the big stuff has been one new Flashpoint campaign, a bunch of new like random missions in the bucket of missions, a lot of new events because you're on this mercenary ship and you're going to and fro, and they're like little events will pop up, and then a ton of just new mechs with unique abilities and unique equipment. One, I think that's interesting if you're an old school Battletech fan, is I think most of these are unseen, which was a class of mech that, I mean, so if you're an old school Battletech fan or you like 80s, 70s and 80s, really just 80s mech anime, a lot of these are just straight up from Macross or from Dogrum. Look up the unseen in relation to Battletech, and basically what happened is in the 80s they licensed a bunch of these designs straight from a kind of like anime licensor. And then found out maybe that licensing wasn't necessarily legit. It was complicated. And Harmony Gold, who has the license to Macross and refuses to ever put it out in a reasonable way in the U.S., only releasing Robotech instead, there was a settlement, and they stopped using those designs. They stopped using those designs, and now, because of recent legal stuff, a lot of those designs are back in. Some of them have been modified. And so there's, like, a bunch of new mechs. They're not all heavies. I thought they'd all be heavies and assaults when this was first announced because it's called heavy metal. But there's, like, a light in here. There's a couple lights. There's a medium or two. And the big thing is they each have a special mechanic. They each have one special piece of equipment that makes them more like Gundams in the sense that they're very specialized, and they have that sort of like, oh, this is the one that does blank, right? So we already talked about the Assassin, which has the intercept system that makes it better at attacking mechs that have high kind of evasion ticks on them, like they have evasion whatever chevrons.
The farther your mech moves, it builds that evasion tick. It makes it harder to hit.
There's one, the Phoenix Hawk has a thing where like it can jump further and it can does more damage when it lands. So you're just hopping all over the battlefield. The Vulcan is really interesting. One, it looks like a fucking linebacker. If you were listening to the current Friends of the Table stuff, the Road to Partisan, I imagine that Memphis Longhand's mech looks just like the fucking Vulcan. If you just heard me say the name Memphis Longhand and you were like, I got to listen to that, you should look up Friends of the Table. The Vulcan does more melee damage, and it has a thing where it's like the all the support class weapons, which are normally only things that fire at super close range, get like 90 meters of extra range. So suddenly, like, small lasers are pretty fucking good because they're pretty heat efficient and they do 20 damage, and you can get into that range pretty quick. Stuff like
quick
that. There's
question.
Yes.
What are these all the heaviest class?
No, that's what I'm saying. They're all spread. So, like, the Assassin is a light mech, the Rifleman, the Phoenix Hawk, and the Vulcan were mediums. It's like 2, 2, 2, and 3 or something like that. Some of them are terrifying. I've had to fight the Archer twice, and each time it's fucked me up. The Archer has a thing called the Missilery Suite, which gives better damage from SRMs and then better LRM clustering. So, like, you know how the long-range missiles in this game do this, like, each one kind of rolls a die to get a hit,
right?
This ensures that they tend to hit the same piece of the mech more often, which means, like, if you want to shred someone's arm off, you can do that in this mech. And so there is feature creep. Like, this is, like, a bunch of extra – it's exactly what you said, Rob.
Immediately thought, wait, so if you do an arc shot, are you going for the head, basically? Like,
you could always do that. Remember that you have to target – you have to spend morale or whatever to do an individual target piece. But, yeah, that's a great
– I just mean, like when you would do indirect, instead of going straight, it would go up
and then
come down.
Yes.
So, like – there's what, like, the shoulders and the head, and like the head's the smallest.
I don't think it targets shoulders, head when you're doing the LRM over a mountain or whatever. I think it's just targeting the front, but maybe I'm wrong. Rob,
I feel like I can see the top down.
It does not have a top down view. It does not. I put like 25 hours into this. I would be fucking up people's heads. There is a height advantage that might do that if you're aiming down at someone, actually, that might do that. But I don't think I think the LRMs do like a loop and then straight. Otherwise they would be OP at that specific thing.
No,
I do get hit in the head a lot, so what the fuck do I know?
I am curious. So they tried 1.0, they were like, LRMs might be too godlike.
Yes.
Which was putting it mildly, because really quickly incredible. You were just like, put LRMs on everything, knock them the fuck over, and then kick them while they are down.
100%.
Like, basically, it was just, who's like, one legs? Guy no shoved somebody over, and then the rest of the crew would just, like, run up on them.
Still a strategy.
Yeah, I'm curious. Like, does the Archer bring that meta back into play where it's like, brutal. Well, what if you just hit them with a million LRMs?
Totally. 100%. But the thing is, like, I've played now the campaign from the jump, where most of the stuff none of it pops up in the campaign itself. I've never fought one of these mechs in a campaign story, only inside. So they haven't, like, I don't think that they've reconfigured the main missions to account for these mechs. I don't think. Maybe one snuck in and I didn't notice it. Where I'm finding them is in the side story stuff and in the store, which is one of the other big changes. They filled the stores with just good end game stuff, or good stuff according to what the planet is. And they really turned up the dial on what you'll find. If you go to a planet that's like former Star League, you know, planet, you're going to find lost tech there. You're going to be able to find a Gauss rifle or ammo for a Gauss rifle. And it very much feels like it's settled into place like MMOs do, where they're like, all right, we're making this game for the people who are still playing Battletech. they lost a Gauss rifle. I want them to be able to get the fucking Gauss rifle back. That's what the build is.
This is where I something I do kind of like. I contain multitudes.
Yeah, of
course. I know I said that, like, too much complexity muddying up the clear relationships of the 1.0 version is bad. But
yeah,
something I do like is that another thing that has happened is that there's so much more room now to specialize your mechs in ways beyond pure loadout, in ways that will, like, encourage different tactics. So in the fiction, there was always this idea of, you'd introduce, for instance, the concept of, like, this is a command and control mech. Mm-hmm. But in the rules of Battletech, that is a meaningless concept. The command and control is the person pushing the little standees around the table. Like, that's command and control. There's no idea of a mech fulfilling that role.
Yep.
But now there's a lot more gear that you can put on that is not purely weapons, that will have squad effects, will have individual mech effects, and might encourage you to experiment with different builds. One thing that I grabbed pretty early, I found pretty early on, was I found a cool heat exchanger.
That thing is dope.
That cuts 10% of the heat output on weapons.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's not a. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
A bog standard heat sink sinks 3 heat that's generated. Uh-huh. So there's a point where a heat exchanger is not worth it. And usually that's in the lower class, like lighter mechs. You're just not, the math is not going to work. But when you start getting into, like, the heavy mech territory, especially the ones that are, like, just laser boats, just tons of hard points for lasers, suddenly that heat exchanger is doing the work that you would have had to have multiple heat sinks there to deal with. And suddenly it's like, okay, an entirely different build is open to me here. The way I manage heat can be different. Like, at this point, it's not going to help with jump shots. Mm-mm. But if you just want to run up on somebody and hit them with every single laser in the known universe, the heat exchanger's there.
Yeah. Classic Alpha Strike.
Classic Alpha Strike.
Love it.
Yeah, that stuff is great. Stuff that does, like, extra, like, a range finder that gives you extra view distance. So if you want someone who's basically a spotter for you, put that on a light that can, like, draw. In fact, now there's, like, the tag system and the narc system, which are two spotting tools, are both in the game. Tag is like a medium laser, but instead of doing damage, it makes it so that whatever gets hit by it gets 10% more damage from anyone who hits it. Ooh. That round. So if you have, like, a light that's out of heat because it just blasted its coil laser or whatever, the way I do, you then can tag instead, and then that is suddenly this kind of command class mech that's all about raising the, or, you know, between that and having a rangefinder so it can see things far away to kind of target them for your missile boat in the back. All that stuff, I think, works to do exactly what you said, Rob, which is, like, it opens up the complexity away from just, I think about this game a lot as being hard to introduce people to, because it's hard to communicate what makes a mech a mech. Because what makes a mech in Battletech, and this is old school tabletop Battletech, is how many hard points it has, where those hard points are they on the arms for extra stability? Are they on the body for not that? how heavy is it? How can you kind of manage the weight, its kind of weight capacity, with what its needs are for armor? Mm. You know, what really separates a Shadowhawk from a Griffin, right? And the answer is, like, if you play this game, you can work out what that is. But I'm just showing it to a new player. Like, these are two medium mechs. They got some shit on their shoulders. How do I differentiate that? And so on one hand, you're right that it's adding a lot more complexity to where you could be, like, if you're high level, you can start picking that stuff out. But what I like about the idea of these special mechs that have something built in is that when you see for the first time the Rifleman, which has a system called the Rangefinder Suite, which reduces long-range attack penalties and which extends its view distance, like, that's a sniper. That mech is a sniper. I'm going to put long-range attack stuff on this thing and make it be a sniper. I almost wish that some of that stuff in a Battletech 2, I almost wish some of that stuff would be, if not built into every mech, give every mech a quirk like that, maybe, at least be like, oh, this would be a place where you would put the Rangefinder Suite. This is a great mech for a Coil M or whatever it is. And I know that this stuff already says, like, Skirmisher Brawler. Like, it already gives you, like, a breakdown of the way the mech is supposed to be used or whatever. But these specific mechanical abilities help you conceptualize what those mechs could do on the field for you so well. I really, really like that stuff. I contain multitudes too, but most of my multitudes are like, yeah, that rules. Put more mechs in it.
I think something else, as I come back to this, and there's this new stuff. So I think, actually, a non-trivial thing, there is a lot more battle tech in this game than there was the last time I spent, like, serious time with it. There are a lot more maps.
Yeah.
It seems like it's pulling from different scenario setups that I've seen before. For instance, just before we recorded, I had a milk run.
Uh-huh.
Go so fucking sideways for the dumbest reasons. So I had a mission where it was just like, the Free Worlds League was like, go kill this diplomat. And I was, I
shout
just got, and I
the
just
Free World League. Oh, this world is fucked. Anyway, continue.
Look, we love sovereignty, but not for everyone.
You know how I feel about autonomous nations, but.
So I take this assassination mission. This is literally right after you've done the Pirate Queen shit. And this time they gave me two heavies out of the gate.
Ooh.
They gave me a Centurion, like, right away. Which I, like, and this was, I don't remember this being scripted, but it was Yang telling me that, oh yeah, aboard the Argo, we found the Centurion. And I was like,
interesting.
Did I just get a Centurion randomly last time and I have no memory of it? Mm. I don't think so. They gave me basically a stripped down, like, Centurion chassis, no weapons. And then I got the Pirate Queen's quick draw. So your first like heavy. And I'm like, cool. All I've got is this easy mission to go kill this diplomat, light escorts. I'm just going to wreck house here. And I set up my squad, roll out, and it's a mountainous jungle map. And so far, so good. And then I see a fire starter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then another fire starter. And then another. And it's all like the way I'm positioned, I can't get any range. Like this entire thing, I've got this like sharpshooter build for all my units. And we are fighting over these little ridges covered in freaking foliage. And it's hot and the lasers are not efficient in this scenario.
Yeah.
And so it just becomes this nightmare of watching my brand new quick draw. I just waded in there. I was like, I am just going to wreck house among these light mechs. And I just got worked.
Oh.
Like they just all just set me on fire, heat spiked through the roof. And then they just started punching me.
That's so funny.
And so I watched my new quick draw literally had just finished being refurbed. Just like arms being flung off, like components going down, like watch all the jump jets like go away. And I'm like, oh, this is not good.
This is not what I wanted.
No. And it was all like, if you looked at the two lance compositions, like it was my four mediums and heavies versus like six lights. This should have been a milk run.
Yeah.
But instead it was all these fire starters just going ham. And then they were getting spotting data for two Panthers that just stood at a distance and just plinked PPC shots into my guys consistently. And I kept trying to go away, get away. I was like, okay, disengage, run, like pull back. But as long as they had line of sight, apparently PPC can hit you from effectively anywhere.
Jesus Christ.
It was so good. I am so angry. Good. Like I basically like the first mission with the new shit and my mercenary company is basically broke. And two of my pilots can't work for the next 3 months.
Right. They're just on their fucking asses costing, you know, and it costs money to keep those pilots around. And I do it because I'm a good employer. I hit a mission pretty early on, Rob. I think I may have messaged you about it where it was a tier two mission or a two difficulty mission. And it was a bit, it was like, hey, there, you know what it was? It was like after the first or second major plot beat, I think maybe pre-Smithen, but post the pirate, I have the Argo at this point. Mm. Random pool, you know, two difficulty thing. And it was like, oh, there's some Taurian terrorists on this planet. You know, can you just go take them out? They're at a base. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay. You go take them out. And they're like a couple mediums and two, it's like two mediums and two lights. And they're at a base on the, like, let's say the east side of this map, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like moving in towards it. And then they're like, you know, Darius comes on and is like, uh-oh, commander. Like, okay, D, what's up? What's happening? Why are you like this? And he's like, Sumeray just noted, we got some new contacts off to the west. They're Davion. Like, okay, why are they here? And it turns out they were bounty hunters hunting down the same terrorists for what the terrorists had just done off screen. And it was, suddenly there's a third faction here. I'm like, all right, whatever. I'll go sweep out these shitheads. I'll turn around. If the bounty hunters want to fight, I can fight them. They land, and it is a thunderbolt, and I have a quick draw at this point, and that is it. I did not get a second heavy from that, the pirate queen, and an Atlas. They had an Atlas, Rob.
No.
And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? People listening, an Atlas is an assault class, super heavy, way too early to fight this thing. And a Thunderbolt is already going to push me. A Thunderbolt already is like a good mid-tier heavy mech. I love the Thunderbolt. I'll rock a Thunderbolt till I die. Fucking Atlas showed up, and I have like them on my west, and on the east is the, and the, on the west they had this plateau. So I was like, okay. And then this was like a really interesting tactical puzzle for me. Because if I get caught in the middle, I'm getting pinced, right? But I also don't want to put them both on my front where they're turning around and punching me. And so I had to, like, use this plateau to lose sight of as many of them as I could, hold out for them to engage, and then sweep in behind the Atlas and just try to pop it from the back as hard as I could. It ended up being, like, a tough fight, but I ended up, like, making it work, and it felt so, so good.
You got the Atlas with
I got one part of the Atlas. I could not get the whole. We killed it.
We
absolutely, like, killed it.
That you won is
killed it. It was incredible. It was like, this is the you have to understand, I came back to this game, I started playing the campaign feeling like, starting this game from the beginning again is weird. Like, I don't have any of my toys. I don't have any of, like, the stuff. My characters aren't particularly good, so my hit rates are shit. Like, all that stuff that's like, And then this mission happens. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm all the way back in. Like, this is the good battle tech. This is mid-game battle tech. I have enough toys to play with. I have enough tools at my disposal to solve an interesting crisis. And this is a moment that didn't happen the first time I played the game. So to your point, Rob, like, yes, BattleTech as a game, I think, is in a really good point to play it as, like, from the jump in a way that it wasn't last year. I like that. That game was my game of the year last year.
Yep,
I think it's way stronger now as a product. It's also way more expensive right now if you wanted to buy everything with the DLC. Yeah. But it's DLC I'm playing. I never play DLC. I'm the DLC hater. I cannot do it. Like, I do not ever jump back into a game. And this completely has me.
Well, I think something that is going to serve BattleTech well, I think, as it expands in this way, bearing in mind some of my reservations, is that BattleTech is inherently kind of loose in a way a lot of tactics games are not. Like, playing this after a lot of Unity of Command in the last week. Unity of Command, it's not a puzzle game. You still have room to make mistakes and recover from them, but by and large, it is a game where you're like, that was a bad move,
right?
And I know I made a bad move, and now the game is going to wallop me for it. BattleTech is a little bit more of an accretional process in terms of how battles go. Like, you can make a bad move, and you will pay for it, but the point of having a battle mech is that it can absorb punishment for making bad moves.
Right.
You've just made an inefficient move, and you'll pay in money and time to the point in your review of the game, the fact that, like, you're watching money flaking off, you know, your mech. Like, mistakes are time and money. But what you don't have is this, like, hard counter or one mistake is guaranteed fatal or a disaster. Instead, what you have is battles that feel really, like, organic and rowdy, I guess is the way I'd put it. Like, in the middle of these giant, like, clusterfucks of a tactical situation, instead of sitting there being like, oh, damn, what's the only way out of this? BattleTech is kind of a game that encourages you to be like, you know what, fuck it. Everyone close and engage. Just beat the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, we'll win it ugly. And that is not in fashion in a lot of tactics games, but my God, do I love it in BattleTech.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think it is. It sits so differently in my mind amongst the types of tactics games I really love. And I'm really happy to say a year on, it is a stronger game than it was then. I think right now there's a package where you can get all of the DLC for $30 or something, Kato?
Yeah,
you were just looking at it, right?
Yeah, until December 3rd, so.
Okay, so when you hear this, you'll have a couple days still.
But it's The whole game, including all the DLC, is $44.99 right now.
That's a
and
good deal.
Just the DLC, if you already own the base game, is $33.
Yeah, so. Totally. I feel like it's in some ways a tougher offer to make for people who've played all of this stuff to completion. Like if you try to wring everything you could out of Flashpoint and Urban Warfare, Heavy Metal's good, but is it that good? I don't know. If you missed BattleTech or you only played BattleTech at the launch, getting all of this DLC produces so many distinct new environments to play in, so many new mission types that, like, I think that does add up. And I also, there are some small things that feel like the sort of balance changes that are really clever in a sense. So, like, Urban Warfare, I think it was Urban Warfare, came with the Raven, which was the first of these mechs that has a kind of a built-in special system that had an electronics countermeasure thing that could kind of jam. It could hide all your mechs, and it could keep you safe from hide them all visually unless someone was inside of a certain cone or certain radius, and made it harder to be hit by indirect fire in general, or maybe even possible to be hit by indirect fire. Except now there's mortars. So, like, having people put together in a tight space is just, you're a walking target at this point if you happen to come across a mission where someone has a mortar. And that is a really fun balance change. I will say none of that stuff is in the Versus, like, they didn't put any of this new stuff in the Versus, which seems weird. I don't know if that's a balance thing or what, but I'm a little like on that. What were you going to add there, Rob?
I was just going to ask your feelings about the flashpoints overall, because they keep adding more flashpoints as well.
I like them.
Me too.
I like them. I miss the pomp of the main campaign a little bit.
Yes.
Do you feel the same way?
Like, yeah, like, seeing the opening titles, which now call it BattleTech Restoration, which again I do not remember the game being called when it first launched.
Right.
So I'm, part of me when I see that, I'm still hopeful that, like, hey, maybe before we see BattleTech 2, we get something like BattleTech,
Fourth Succession War. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the thing I dig about it is just the flashpoints. The whole conceit of there being like chained missions is so valuable here, because so much of BattleTech is these one-offs, and it's still great as a one-off. I find the flashpoints, what they add, is a harrowing element that was sometimes missing from BattleTech, where it's like, okay, we got through that part of the gauntlet, but now we have to get through the rest of it, and I don't know how, with how banged up these forces are, how I'm going to do that. But sometimes it's really fun to have to, like, play it from that situation rather than always going in fresh with the mechs and mech warriors that you've rested and waited for.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's totally accurate for me too. Like, I also think the thing that flashpoints add is choices, which is fun, right? Like, hey, I had one set of missions in a flashpoint that was about helping a House Merrick squad up against some Steiner stuff and putting artillery markers down. And it was like a pretty fun mission. It was like one of those missions where you had to be a little faster than what I'd outfitted. And I was like, I don't know if I can make it across this map quickly enough. I have to get to these 3 points to drop these markers within 10 turns. And I'm really running assaults and heavies at this point, and even the heavy isn't moving as fast as I want. And then halfway through the mission, these House Merrick, like military crew rolled in on my team and, like, totally pulled attention off of me and gave me the extra firepower to clear a route to get to the point literally with one turn left. It was like, oh man, this is fantastic. Love it. And then that mission wrapped up, and then, you know, go back up to space, and the third flashpoint thing kicked off, which was like, you know, it's been a day or two, and those same soldiers that I had been teamed up with are now in the shit being pursued by House Steiner, and House Steiner is offering me money to stay out of it. And they're like, you know what? You don't have any, you know, you just let us deal with this. Maybe we'll give you another opportunity to make it right by us, because you just hurt us as a mercenary group. Or you could go help the crew that had just helped you, but for like no money. And it was like, all right, well, they pulled me out of the shit. I'm going to pull them out of the shit. You know what? Darius, fire up that leopard. Let's get down there. I'm gonna save their asses, and I did, and it felt good. And then also you get loot, because that's the other new thing that the flashpoints added, is when you finish a flashpoint, you get basically a loot box, like that feeling of like a fancy, you know, graphic plays, and a like a hangar door opens, a graphical hangar door opens, and inside is a giant
the Fabergé laser. Overlord.
Yeah, exactly. And inside you get like a part for a heavy mech and a cool gun, and you're like, yeah, okay, works for me.
I think. Something else with the combination of campaign content, flashpoints, and then I think it was already part of the sort of the subtext of the campaign, but then there's also all these additional missions that pop up on the market. It feels like at this point they've done a very good job of creating a fictional universe of mercenary work.
Yeah.
And in the first game, it felt just kind of like conceit, where really you were just trying to, you know, money in, money out, make them balance. That was kind of the name of the game. Now it feels a little bit more like I do have relationships with different factions, yeah. And those do become an asset, because there's places I'm going to want to shop, and there's places I'm going to go to kick ass, and those might be two different places.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like sketchy mercenary work that you're getting from like weird randos out there. The states do tend to pay a bit better, but they tend to ask harder jobs. And there is a meaningful difference. Like they seem to have done a good job of, when you are told like, oh, that is a Great House mech lance that just deployed, chances are you're about to encounter a real force, yeah, of mechs, not broken down like pirate mechs or anything, but like people in better shit than you've got, perfectly maintained.
Damn.
And you realize like, oh, damn, like, I'm playing a lot of this game on a slightly easier setting just by virtue of like fully repairing my mechs. Now I'm facing the varsity.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I also think like the new events have all been really good. The kind of random events that pop up on the Argo as, yep, you move around the systems. You know, a famous mercenary group is trying to like headhunt one of your pilots. Like, all right, do you, and it's going to like basically offer you payment for taking them away from you. Like, do you take that payment? Do you send them off in good spirits? Do you tell them to rethink it? Love those little moments. I still wish there was more. This is like my biggest, yep, request for Battletech 2. I want Valkyria Chronicle style quirks and like aspects to these, my pilots. I want my pilots to not just be, and there are a little bit of that. Like, you'll occasionally get a thing where it's like, oh, this pilot is a technician, which means there's a better chance for them succeeding at this random event or whatever. But I want pilots to have like characteristics. I want a certain pilot to be really good with PPCs and be able to keep a little bit of heat off that PPC for some reason, you know, stuff like that. But I still think with these events, I feel tighter with this crew than I did with my starter crew. I feel like there is even a little bit more character because they pop up more often, and it's not the same, you know, 25, 30 events. It's another 30 events from all of the different expansions at this point. It's good.
And that's in like
I am also campaign. Trying to role play a little more.
Oh, are you? Welcome to my heart.
my new mech pilot, yeah, is from the deep periphery.
Ooh, okay.
Goes by the call sign Ghost.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But he's disgraced and on the run.
Okay.
Because he's perhaps a little too puckish, a little too insouciant. And so Ghost, last name Bear, B-A-Y-E-R.
Ah, okay.
Is just out there running around the Innersphere, just doing mercenary jobs, looking around, seeing what's what.
Just seeing what's what. Just trying to get a sense of the thing.
Which is perfectly, mind you, in the fiction.
Uh-huh.
A group called Wolf's Dragoons shows up in the middle of the Innersphere,
yeah,
with a shit ton of mechs out of nowhere.
Yep.
One of the mech warriors with them, Natasha Kerensky, shares a name with a famous, like, every child knows this general's name.
Yeah.
A general who left the Innersphere in the wake of their great apocalypse and was never heard from again. This group shows up from the same direction and are like, hey, what's up? We're just here to take mercenary work with all the major political actors in the Innersphere. And this is our associate, Natasha Kerensky. No relation. Yeah. And everyone's like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
definitely. There's nothing weird about Wolf's Dragoons.
God, it's so funny. So, yeah, I mean, what I will say is, I'm based on the stuff I've already seen and some murmurings, I do think that Heavy Metal is going to include a pretty heavy clan invasion nod and set that up. People want it so bad, and I think you're right that it could go bad, because to. It's like one of those things where, like, do you respect the fiction or you respect the gameplay balance? And if you respect the fiction, there should be no gameplay balance. Like, when the clans invade, it is a fucking stomp. They have better shit. They have a better shit and a culture built around using that better shit. And I'm curious how to tell that story. I think there's a lot of cool ways to tell that story in a tactics game. Like, you've written before, Rob, about the ways in which kind of real-time strategy game levels can tell stories by putting you in various positions of power and disempowerment. I think you can do that in a tactics game. I think it might be a hard pill to swallow if you are playing as someone from one of the successor states or a smaller power caught in the middle or whatever it is. I think it'd be a really tough one, but I would love to see them try it if that makes sense.
I think the reason I'm really keen to see Fourth Succession War, because I know everyone's chomping at the bit for the clans.
They really are.
The clans are one of those end of history threats that are really frustrating. Like, just we have to get all the forces on the same side. Now we form the Grand Alliance.
Yeah. And it's so easy to imagine it's a video game. That's the thing, right? You could imagine that game happening.
Right. The narrative itself felt like a video game. Yeah. It felt very God. And then the hero's journey is the one dude is captured. It's basically Call of the Wild, but with mechs.
Yeah.
The one kid from the Kellhounds is captured in the first engagement and rises from a slave to Khan of the Wolf Clan.
Yeah.
And just because he's so badass and his dick's so good, apparently, is the that's the Stackpole.
This is what you got to live with when you're reading 1980s tabletop game tie-in fiction.
But what interests me about doing Fourth Succession War instead is it feels to me like Harebrained is going back, the people working on Battletech, and sort of questioning the way a lot of things were portrayed in that fictional universe. The Great Houses all seem a little more self-serving, a little nastier than they're portrayed in the novels. Life on the periphery is seen as maybe not the sort of benighted hellhole that it was portrayed in a lot of the original source books. There are like valuable things and experiences out there and cultures. And I would be really curious to see them revisit the Fourth Succession War, which is basically the story of like, what if Bismarck was good? Like, what if he was really good and like sort of the Blitzkrieg campaigns against like Austria and France were totally just and good. And we were happy that basically the sort of militaristic fascists won. I'd be really curious to see them approach that source material from the direction they've been approaching Battletech this whole time.
Yeah.
Right. Like how does that story look from the perspective they've adopted for a lot of Battletech?
Which is a perspective that sees the great houses, the great successor states, as being terrifying with the amount of power that they can bring to bear, indifferent to the lives of individual people unless they're well connected. And fundamentally, whatever their ideological differences are between themselves, invested in the status quo writ large that allows them to maintain all of the power. That first game is also about reinstating a monarchy. So like there is a degree of like, I'm curious. It's why I'm curious and not just confident. You know what I mean? Like there could totally be a version of that story that is just like, hoorah. That is just like the They Are Billions campaign. That's the nightmare version of it. I think enough of the content is good and enough of the team is diverse, right? That I do have, I do lean towards confidence that they could do the Fourth Succession War really well and find a perspective on it where even if they have to keep the canon events the same, you're seeing those events from a different perspective that kind of shines a light on what is actually transpiring, because maybe the player of the game doesn't have to just be someone who wants to project themselves as the hero of all time into it, you know?
Yeah.
And certain ideas of what strength looks like.
You're just a humble mech commander showing up and be like, hey, where you want these mechs?
God. We should note real quick, I guess, before we wrap up, that not tomorrow. I don't know when this is going up. Sometime
this is today.
Okay, so then sometime next 2 weeks, three, how far away is it? MechWarrior 5 is supposed to happen sometime in the future. We're supposed to start playing that game sometime in the future.
Imminently.
Imminently. I'm so curious about that game, Rob. How are you feeling as we go into MechWarrior 5?
The fact I have no feel for what this game is going to be makes me apprehensive.
Yeah.
I would say I am not sanguine, Austin.
Yeah. Yeah. Kato?
When did the last MechWarrior even come out?
MechWarrior 4 Mercenaries would have been... Okay, wait, you're not counting online. You're talking about like full single player campaign.
Yeah.
Was this really the last one? Was this really the last single player MechWarrior game?
Because it feels like it's been...
How long do you think it is?
Was that even this decade?
No. Absolutely not.
All right, I'm going to say 2001.
You're damn close. 2002 was MechWarrior 4. MechWarrior Online...
No, that's also the same year that the MechWarrior Dark Age tabletop clicks game came out.
Nice. Yeah, there was probably a big push around it, right? Yeah. 2013 was when MechWarrior Online came out. Mm-hmm. That game's been all right, and it's those developers, I believe, who are working on this, Piranha Games. They're using a different engine. They're using Unreal instead of using CryEngine, so they're not just like porting over stuff, as far as I know. It has been... It's an Epic Games exclusive, an Epic Store exclusive, like Shenmue 3. That's a joke that's not going to land until Friday or Thursday or whatever.
Episode.
I just want Ryo to be in a mech. I just so badly. Do you know where I can find some PPCs?
Have you seen the Clanners? The Clans.
What do you know about Kerensky? I just love his affectless completely. Oh God. That game, I was really excited for that game last year or 2 years ago when they announced it, I think. And it was supposed to be coming out last holiday. I was like, yes. Then it was supposed to come out this spring, I want to say. And I was like, cool. And now I'm like, MechWarrior 5 coming out in December. It's coming out. In December of this year, I think. I think it will. It's so close. They did an AMA, and that AMA went weird because of the Epic Game stuff. Hmm. And people are pissed about that. People have been skeptical. Like, they really liked some of the early footage, and then I think recent footage has been like, oh, I don't like the UI, etc. Then, and also, they kind of went radio silent. There just wasn't any PR for this game for months. There just wasn't anything big and, like, juicy, and then last week they released like a 5-minute walkthrough video.
Oh,
that's just like it was actually less than that. It was 4 minutes because it is the most condensed 4 minutes I've ever seen. and also like the audio isn't that good in it. It feels kind of like rushed and real. Like it's one of those things where like the audio isn't compressed and sound removed. You know what I mean?
You're right.
Which is not a drag, but it is one of those things that produces an effect where you're like, oh, we're moving through a lot of stuff really quick. I'm not really getting a lot of questions answered necessarily. These mechs look cool. I like being in this big mech hangar. That's cool.
Nice.
but I don't know what it's gonna. I don't know what it's gonna feel like. I don't know what it's gonna be. You know? So there's a big map.
And it feels like at this point we should have an idea.
That's what it is. I want the hour-long video by now. That's the thing I want is like, here is the fucking game. Here is what it is like to be a mercenary in the world of Battletech / MechWarrior. I think the map looks dope. I think the idea, it's like, that. It's the same basic pitch of being a mercenary commander. Could be really, really fun. I hope things feel weighty. I hope things feel like the combat is interesting and not just kind of like... point and shoot, because that's one of the things that was so unique about the MechWarrior games, you know, forever, is the sense of scale, the sense of permanence to the combat in those games is so unique. Even in the multiplayer stuff, it's so fascinating to play a multiplayer game where you're in a gunfight and then your solution is like to back the fuck off and let the people behind you charge forward a little bit so you can get some of the heat off of you, both literally to cool down yourself and also so people aren't pointing guns at you anymore. There's such a different vibe. And that actually comes through in the tactic in Battletech as a tactics game for sure, where you're like, oh my God, my core is orange. I can't. You go hide behind that hill and just lob LRMs at these people. But we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. I'm hopeful.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I want to see this game. I'm excited to being a mech. Austin Walker, 2019.
Do you have to put a year on that?
Austin Walker, 2019. Running for office, for mech office. Said I wasn't going to do it.
Dress for the job you want.
Yep.
Austin puts on a giant neuro helmet.
Boom. Yeah, exactly.
Got to get this good contacts. All right.
Have to.
I think that will do it for this edition of Waypoint Radio. Be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. I think we're a 5-star podcast, but that's for you to say. You'll get to decide, just like we're going to decide about that BattleTech game. We're gonna have to face some hard truths. Think hard about how we feel about these things. I think we'll get there. You can follow everything we do on Twitter at Waypoint and find our website at waypoint.vice.com. I'm going to be saying that forever, right? That's basically it. I'm just never going to learn our actual URL.
It redirects.
Our actual URL is bad.
That's true.
That's true.
Vice.com/en_us/games.
Nope.
You're wrong. That's rough.
Something?
Waypoint.vice.com/games.
/games. not /gaming. /gaming doesn't exist.
Good.
But vice.com/gaming, it will take you to the topic gaming, which is different than the topic games.
Yeah.
Because Vice's CMS is like that. There's no easy fix.
You can follow me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Austin, where can people find you?
Austin_Walker.
Ricardo.
At @A_Cotto_appears.
And our theme music was the track Miss You by Bowen off the EP Pale Machine. You can learn more at waypoint.zone/Bowen. We'll have another episode of Waypoint Radio later this week. I think we are dipping into the question bucket for Thanksgiving. But in the meantime, continue to question the neoliberal consensus.
Good.
That's my call to arms for 2020.
Love it.
Hey, I'm not saying we overthrow it.
Yeah.
I'm just out here asking questions.